We're going to talk today about two of the most famous philosophers who have ever lived. In fact, I'm going to mention a third as well. There were three philosophers who overlapped each other in ancient Athens and set their mark between them on the whole of Western philosophy ever since. And I'm referring to Plato, who we should be talking about mostly, whose teacher in Athens was just as famous, Socrates, and whose pupil, who I will also be looking at today, was Aristotle. And it is a remarkable thing that three of the greatest minds that the human race has produced should all be virtually contemporaries. And certainly if any football team were being selected of the 11 greatest philosophers, all three would be in that team. Now, we don't know a great deal about Socrates' actual teaching except through the writings of Plato. Socrates didn't write anything, but it seems that Plato was a very assiduous student and took down notes. And in his writings, Plato's that is, he brings out very often what Socrates had been saying. We assume that is the case. It is very difficult to be absolutely certain whether what Plato writes or puts into the mouth of Socrates was Socrates' thinking or Plato's commentary on it. But between the two of them, I think we've got a fairly clear picture of what the ideas were. Plato himself was born in 427 BCE and lived for 8 years, died in 347. He was born into a noble family, and his family wanted him to go into politics, but he wasn't very interested in doing that. And for really the first 40 years of his life, he spent building up knowledge and experience. He did a lot of traveling. He went to Italy, to Sicily, to Egypt, and only became famous, or only began to involve himself in the things that made him famous, when he'd reached the age of 40. And it was at this time he founded his academy in Athens, to which students were invited, and he became their teacher. I think the best thing is simply to outline what he said, and then to see how Aristotle, his pupil, took over from him. The first thing to say about Plato is that he was extremely comprehensive. He was the first person to write down systematically the whole range of philosophical ideas. So in that, he is the signpost for all that followed. And in fact, there are many relatively modern philosophers who speak of Plato as being the last word on virtually everything. One philosopher of the 19th century, A.N. Whitehead, lived on into the 20th century, said of Plato that the whole of the rest of philosophy is simply a series of footnotes to him, to Plato. Now, this may well be a bit of an exaggeration, but if you are studying philosophy in any detail, and whatever your area you're looking at, almost certainly at some point you will have to turn to see what Plato had to say about it. Now, it's not always easy to read Plato, because he wrote in what we call Socratic discourse or Socratic dialogue. That is to say, he put his teaching in the mouths of different figures. Socrates is a regular one, who put forward a point of view. One puts forward a point of view, and then he writes an alternative point of view or a question, and it reads rather like a play, in which an idea is pursued. Not always to a conclusion. You might get a bit frustrated if you look to Plato for a whole series of answers to your problems. Mind you, that's the case with philosophy generally. Philosophy doesn't claim to give any answers. What it suggests is that if you study philosophy, you'll ask more intelligent questions. And that is really what Plato is attempting to bring about in the minds of his pupils and his readers. Now, there are two particular aspects of Plato's thought which are central and which we must look at in a little bit of detail. And the first is the very famous concept that he has, his idea of the forms, which doesn't sound very exciting, forms, but he's using the word form in the sense of ideal. You see, what he says is that everything that we see around us, whether it's a chair or a wall or a house or a vehicle of some sort, whatever we see is, he suggested, a copy of the invisible ideal example of that, the form of that. The chair I'm sitting on is a copy of the ideal chair. And he argued that the ideals are to be found in the ideal world, the world of forms, which loosely, I suppose, we can call heaven. So everything is a copy, an imperfect copy perhaps, but nonetheless a copy of the ideal that is there in heaven. Now, okay, that's one way looking at it in terms of manufactured objects. But he then applies it, and this is the interesting bit, he then applies this concept to human qualities, to qualities like courage, or justice, or compassion, or equality, or freedom. The great ideals that we continually proclaim as our end or goal, politicians proclaim them, anybody who's enthusiastic to improve the lot of the human race will quote these ideals. Now, it is difficult to define them, you see. How do you define courage? And where does courage originate? How do you define compassion? Where does compassion originate? Where does justice come from? The concept of fair play. These are questions that have puzzled philosophers ever since philosophy was taught, and that means since the time of Plato, certainly. Now, Plato's answer is that these qualities that we try to pursue in our lives, often with great difficulty, usually not perfectly successfully, that these ideal qualities are also to be found in the world of forms, in the ideal world, in heaven. So that although we may say of a particular person that he has been very brave, what Plato suggested was that his bravery, his courage, was an example of the perfect courage which you will find in heaven, in the world of forms. That when a person shows compassion to other people, then that person is again giving an imperfect example of the perfect compassion, the perfect love, which is to be found in heaven. And so on, right through all these great virtues. All of us, in our way, are representing the perfection that is to be found in the world of forms. Well, you may say, how do we know these forms, then? How can we know them? And here, we embark on a very famous analogy that Plato devised. It's called Plato's analogy of the cave. He said that as far as most people are concerned, life is lived as in a cave. He imagines people in the cave. Outside the cave, the real world is going on its way. People are coming and going. But the people in the cave don't see these. All they can see of what is going on outside are the shadows of the people or the things or whatever that are there outside the cave. And they see these shadows on the wall of the cave. And Plato says that to a person who is not, he doesn't use this word, but this is what he means, a person who is not enlightened will form the idea that the shadows are the real thing. And we've got the phrase, they mistake the shadow for the substance. And they can live their whole lives in this misconception that these reflections of the real thing that is going on outside, that the reflections, the shadows, are the real thing. Okay, that's how he sees the vast bulk of the human race, living in a cave, mistaking the shadow for the substance. How then does anybody escape from the cave? Plato says that people must be dragged, if need be, screaming from the cave. They must be brought out into the pure light of day. And he agrees that this will be a painful process, because if you're going to come out and out of the dim light of the cave, to begin with, you're going to be blinded by the full light that is to be found outside it. But it also, and this is the important point, it means actually acknowledging that for however long you've been in the cave, you've been living under this misconception. You have been imagining that that was the reality, when in fact it was not the reality at all. The reality is outside. And the way to achieve this, according to Plato, is through the study of philosophy. That philosophy will open any human being's mind to the reality of the world, of life, as he may encounter it. It may be painful to have to give up some of your childish, inadequate ideas of what is real and what is true, but nonetheless, it must be done. The fact that you can take refuge in an imaginary world with ideas that are not genuine but help you to survive is condemned by Plato. We must question. We must seek the truth of a situation. We must go for the reality rather than for the shadow. And there are many applications one can make of that, of people who get by latching on to some myth or some fairy tale which enables them to pursue their lives without having to come to terms with the reality of the situation. And for many people, it would be very painful to have to look at truth as it really is. And Plato acknowledges this, but he's quite firm about this. He says, if you're really going to be a mature, full human being, then you must stop living in the cave. You must leave your shadows behind and come out into the open, the real light of day. However much it hurts, you must adjust yourself to that. And then you are beginning to be a true, worthwhile person. Now, he adds something else to this, because you could say, well, that's fine, but how can we have any real experience of the world of forms? The philosopher's mind's open to the reality and they realize that these are just copies of this perfect ideal. Can we know these forms at all? And Plato believed that we can, and taught that, in fact, what he taught was reincarnation, that at death our souls go on a journey to this world of forms. They go to heaven, where they are, so to speak, recharged. And a person who has been living with the copies can, for a short time or a length of time, he doesn't specify how long, but for long enough, can live in the real, ideal situation. And this explains a lot in his philosophy, because what it means is that when a person, a soul, is reincarnated, comes into another body, it arrives in this new body having been recently in the world of forms, in the ideal world, and therefore is in a pure, untainted state, more so than an adult who has been in the world and perhaps has been living with the copies rather than with the real thing for much longer. And therefore, in the words of William Wordsworth, who was a Platonist at one time in his life, in his Ode on the Intimations of Immortality, he uses a phrase which Plato could well have used: trailing clouds of glory do we come from heaven, which is our home. And another philosopher who took up this same idea was Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the 18th century French philosopher, who said precisely the same, that the child is in a more perfect state because the child has more recently been in the ideal world than the adult. And it had a lot to do with Rousseau's theory of education, which was that, as far as possible, the child should be kept away from adult issues like history or sociology and so on, and learn about the natural world in which he or she lives. And Rousseau argued that the first 10 or so years of anybody's education should be just learning about the world. Well, this is following on this same idea that Plato initiated, that we come into the world and we are pure, we have been recharged. And that, he said, explains why it is that a small child, long before he's had any experience of the lessening of values that takes place among many people, a small child has a concept of justice. Justice, a very difficult word to define. You try defining the word justice. It's one of these words that you can only really say you will know justice when you experience it. You will know injustice when you experience it. And a child, when very young, will use a phrase like, "That's not fair," as though the child expects things to be fair, to be just. And Plato, his point of view was that the child expects that because that is what he has been most, or she, has been most recently experiencing in the ideal world. So he comes into the world having experienced justice and expecting to find it in the world. And of course, very soon, for most people, this expectation is dashed. But Plato argues, if the child is persuaded to pursue philosophy, then he has the best possible hope of maintaining his ideals and keeping that broader vision which the world of forms endowed him with. So we've got then this unique, I don't think there's been any other philosopher who has put it as clearly, as straightforwardly as Plato has, this world of forms, together, of course, with the concept of the immortal soul. This is very central to Plato. He doesn't specify what exactly the goal eventually be, though one feels that ultimately one would spend the rest of eternity in the ideal world. But he certainly believed in the immortality of the soul, and in that point, he is at one with, for example, the Hindu religion in India, which teaches the same thing, although it doesn't talk about a heaven we go to. It talks about gradually achieving perfection through a series of incarnations. Maybe the same could be applied to Plato. Who knows? Well, that is the first point that he makes. But he then goes on to talk specifically about the value of philosophy. And here we come to what is arguably the most famous philosophy book, if not the most famous book, ever written. And I'm referring to The Republic. One thing one can say immediately about The Republic is that it is eminently readable. I had to read it in Greek at one time, and the Greek is very simple, and any English translation will also reflect that simplicity. It is one of the, it's part of its greatness, I think. Although it's dealing with extremely profound issues, it does so in language that somebody can understand who has not done years and years in the philosophy field. And to me, that's one of the signs of true greatness. Any scholar can be obscure. Any scholar can write at the level that he has achieved himself and write very simply at that level. But if that level, as it almost certainly will be, is above the heads of his readers, then it's not going to be a lot of use to them. The great thing about Plato was that he could make the best, the deepest, the profoundest ideas that he knew understandable to a beginner in the field. And I would absolutely recommend anybody who's interested in pursuing philosophy to get hold of Plato's Republic and read it through. And take to heart the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson, the great American philosopher, who said, this is a quotation from Emerson, "Burn the libraries, for their value is in this book, The Republic by Plato." Now, he's talking about an ideal state. A lot of people get the idea that he's talking about Athens as it was then. Athens was certainly not an ideal state. There were battles for supremacy taking place between the various city-states, and Athens was involved in that, and it was an Athens which had actually put to death his teacher, Socrates, because Socrates was making fun of the state, refused to take these politicians seriously, and was sentenced to death for that. So we're not talking about a real community, or not one as yet that has come into being. Plato is talking about how the ideal the Republic would be, and how, in particular, it should be governed. And his argument is that the key to the whole thing is education. And in a way, when I was saying a moment ago that philosophy is the way of escaping from the cave, I could have used the word education, because in Plato's time, the word philosophy covered the entire syllabus, curriculum, of any school or college or university. It included the sciences and the arts, as well as what we specifically might describe as philosophy today. What has happened, of course, in the interim, since the time of Plato, is that all the other subjects, except a few, have, so to speak, fled the nest and become independent subjects in their own right. But when he talked about philosophy, he was including all the subjects that would be on any curriculum. And his argument was that those who should be involved in the governing of the state, those who should be doing the voting for the rulers, and those who should actually be the rulers, that their basic qualification was by education. Education which he saw as an adventure, as an act of exploration, as, in fact, almost fun. He says in the Republic, "Knowledge that is acquired under compulsion has no hold on the mind. Therefore, do not use compulsion, but let early education be rather a sort of amusement." And many modern schools are trying to bring that about and to get rid of the rather dour atmosphere, which I certainly remember as a boy in the classrooms I had to attend, that a classroom now will try to look like a place where children can play and learn in the process. So that is the key to it. Let early education be rather a sort of amusement. What he saw was, though, that there should be, in order to choose these governors of the state, a series of tests to weed them out, so to speak. And he saw the need for tests at the age of 20, tests at the age of 30, until eventually you have achieved a group of people who have studied virtually all the subjects that are there to be studied, and have got a good grasp, therefore, of the world as it is, of the issues, the problems that come their way, and have realized, and this is perhaps the most important thing that philosophy teaches, that things are seldom as simple as they seem or as easy as they seem, that what seems to be a common, a garden, matter-of-fact point of view may well need a little bit more study if it's to be really understood, and to recognize that for every one point of view, there will be an alternative point of view, and that you've got to work your way through this. And it's no good jumping to conclusions. You've got to study, you've got to learn, and above all, you've got to learn how to think. And this remains, I think, a requirement that needs to be drummed in, if that's not going against the Platonic ideal of education, to every place of learning, that the real aim of education is to help people or teach people how to think. And he believed that the people who should govern the state, and indeed the people who should select the governors, should be entirely from this group, those who had learned how to think for themselves, to stand on their own feet, to look at a problem and to be able to work their own way through the problem and not always be looking around for somebody else to provide the answer. So he sees a core of what you might call philosopher rulers. They're sometimes called philosopher kings. And the governing of the state should be entrusted entirely to these. He says, again in the Republic, until wisdom and political leadership meet in the same man, cities will never cease from ill, nor the human race. Let me just repeat that, because it really is a central theme of Plato, and one that remains absolutely relevant. Until wisdom and political leadership meet in the same man, cities will never cease from ill, nor the human race. So he is suggesting then that it is those who have become what he called philosophers, what we call have studied widely in all areas that are available to be studied, that those are the ones who will make the best governors. And he has other rules for the governors, that they should only govern for a certain length of time, that he doesn't want to see politics as being a career profession. He believes it would be for the benefit of the state that they would almost look upon their time of governing as being a service to the state, and certainly not one of self-aggrandizement, and certainly not one of building up your own wealth. He saw this as a job that you did really gratis. You might be paid your expenses, but that is all. You look upon it as a privilege, not a means of filling your pockets with wealth. So he has this idealistic view of the authority that comes to the process of governing if it is backed by knowledge, by wisdom, by philosophy. And it remains, I think, a requirement today. One might want to ask how far a person who is so broad would be able to involve himself or herself in the nitty-gritty decision-making that politics calls for. Nonetheless, I think there in Plato we have a goal that is worth pursuing. So that is Plato. How far you would call this democracy is a moot point. It is democratic in the sense that a lot of people are involved, that those who are doing the selecting and those who are ruling, it's a group of people. There's no one person who is going to take charge. So we haven't got an autocracy. We haven't got any kind of one-man band. It is bringing in many to so that they would all between them balance each other out, as it were. But he's still rejecting a lot of other people. There's a lot of discussion as to how far he saw women being involved in the process of governing. He certainly ruled out slaves in the process, because he didn't see that slaves who had to do the menial tasks should be allowed the educational process. In that, of course, he was just a child of his times. He had nothing to say about slavery being evil or slavery being wrong or that slavery should be abolished. He accepted it as part of the natural structure of society. He didn't see those involved in what we would call industry and commerce being part of the ruling process. As far as he was concerned, those who made the money, the wealth of the state, should get on doing that. And they can make the money and leave the governing to those who are using their brains. It's rather interesting that there's been quite a reversal in that. Today, he puts the educated people at the top of the list. I think today, businessmen would be more likely in our Western capitalist world to top the list of those who are generally deemed to be the most important. Somebody once said, we haven't got any money, so we've got to think. There's something that's maybe worth pondering on. Well, now, at one point in his into his academy arrived his famous pupil, Aristotle. In fact, Plato was 43 when Aristotle was born. So it's obvious, and his academy had been running then for 3 years. So it's quite obvious that by the time Aristotle arrived in the academy, Plato must have been certainly into his 60s. And Aristotle very quickly became the key figure. Plato called him the mind of the academy. He saw him not only as his star pupil, but as his equal, and gave him all the opportunities he needed in order to make his own progress. Aristotle expected that when Plato died, he would hand the academy over to him, and was very disappointed when he gave it to somebody else. So disappointed that he left the academy and became a tutor in his own right. And at the age of about 50, he founded his Lyceum, Lyceum, which is as famous, really, as Plato's academy. In the Lyceum, and you may have seen classical pictures, there are classical pictures of Aristotle in his Lyceum. He taught peripatetically, there's a nice word for you, peripatetically. In other words, he walked around as he taught. He didn't get pupils or students to come into a room and sit at their desks while he propounded his views. He walked about and asked for questions, and generally was peripatetic. So there we've got a very different picture. And when we come on, people that we link them together because one was the pupil of the other, and we tend to think that Aristotle, therefore, was just continuing the same teaching that Plato had given. Now, obviously, he's not going to disagree on everything. He doesn't disagree about the way a state should be governed, for example. But Aristotle is a very different kettle of fish from Plato, just as brilliant, but in a very different way. Aristotle is, in fact, much nearer to modern philosophy, modern scientific research, than was Plato. See, when Plato talked about the ideal world, the world of forms, he was speculating. There's no verification possible for this. Whether there is such a world or not, we do not know. We may imagine there is, we may hope there is, we may profoundly believe that there is, but there is absolutely no way that we can prove that there is. So similarly, there's no way we can prove that when we come into the world, our immortal souls come in, as it were, recharged. That is all speculative. It allows you to explain the existence of these ideals of bravery and justice and love and freedom and equality and all the other great ideals that we speak of, which are otherwise very difficult to explain where we got these ideals from. It gives you an explanation, but it is not one that you can, in black and white, simply show QED, quod erat demonstratum, as was to be proved, which is what the QED means. Now, Aristotle was quite determined that the only things we could say for certain that were those that were the consequence of observation, of experience, of that which could ultimately be verified. And if they weren't capable of verification, that at least they were logical. Aristotle was the first, wrote the first Encyclopaedia Britannica. Now, that's not literally the case, because obviously he didn't. But when he founded his Lyceum, he decided that what he was going to do in whatever years remained to him, and there were, in fact, only 13 more years left. His dates were 384 to 322 BCE. He lived to be 62, not 80, like Plato. And he was nearly 50 when he founded the Lyceum. That in whatever years were left, he was going to describe everything, I repeat, everything that the world possessed. Everything about the world he would describe. He would write, he would study and describe it and write about it. And that is precisely what he proceeded to do. He wrote voluminously. Obviously, he wasn't always walking around. He all these times of walking around is peripatetic teaching. But his main work was to describe the world that he found, that he observed, that he experienced. And his writing is direct, unlike the writing of Plato, which is a dialogue, so that you're sometimes not quite sure what is being said or what point is being pushed. With Aristotle, things are absolutely crystal clear. He was more of the organized scholar than Plato. Whether that necessarily means he was a greater mind than Plato is another matter. People will debate that. A pointless debate, I think, because they were so different it doesn't really matter. But he was writing directly whatever he was describing, whatever case he was arguing. Now let's look first of all at the physical world, because he looked at that. And he was the first person in the Western world to start to name the various plants and other creatures that he saw around him. In other words, he was the first real biologist. He was a geologist. He described the rocks. He was an astronomer. He described as best he could the universe that he saw around him. He was a physicist. He was a chemist. He described all these, and he wrote on all those scientific subjects, as we now describe them, with great comprehensiveness. He tried to cover everything that could be said on any aspect of the physical world that he saw around him. And in the course of his writings, he completed over 1,000 massive manuscripts. All this in 12 or 13 years. May sound a long time, but for what he was doing, it is absolutely, well, it's beyond belief that he could have written all that he did in that relatively short space of time. And it's the one side, then, of his writing was just simply describing the physical world. The other side, though, was to describe what we might, well, really to ask the question whether there was anything beyond the physical world. And this is where the word metaphysics comes. Physics is to do with the physical world. The word meta in Greek means beyond or after. After the physics. Is there anything, when you've described the physical world, this is the point, is there anything left? Is there anything else that is real which is not included in one's description of the visible, tangible world around us? Is there, in other words, such a thing as metaphysics? What do we mean by the mind? What do we mean by the soul? Is there a God? Is there a life after death? Is there purposiveness in life? All these were questions to which Aristotle turned his mind and wrote about them. To begin with, he instituted the process of logic. He argued that when we are involved in debate, we should adopt certain natural intellectual principles, which he called logic. And the one that he invented was the syllogism, which is still central in modern study of logic, the syllogism, S-Y-L-L-O-G-I-S-M. Now, a syllogism is a statement. Well, it's three statements. One in which you make a general statement, and the second one is an example of the general that you're looking at, the general group that you've mentioned in the first statement, and the third one is the natural, what Aristotle saw as the inevitable conclusion that comes from it. Let me give you an example of a syllogism, because this is if you're studying Aristotle, you'll look at this. The one that he gave related to Socrates. It seems that in the time of Aristotle, the rumor had got around that Socrates, his former teacher's teacher, who had been sentenced to death and died by taking hemlock, that Socrates had not actually died. He had gone into a coma, but had recovered from that, and that Socrates was still alive. The same sort of thing was said after Elvis Presley died. And I believe there are still some people around who say Presley lives or Elvis lives. Well, in the same way as they said that, they said it about Socrates. And Aristotle decided that this absurd notion should be laid to rest once and for all, that there was no such thing as an immortal human being. And so he devised this very famous syllogism. It begins with the statement, all men are mortal. And I presume he included women as well, but what he said was all men are mortal. All right, now nobody's going to have any trouble with that. The one thing that every human being alive knows for sure is that he or she will eventually die. Of that there's no question. So all men are mortal. All agree. Right. Now, the second statement, an example of these all men, Socrates. Socrates, he says, was a man. Nobody's going to deny that. Socrates was certainly a man. So, we've got all men are mortal. Socrates was a man. Ergo, therefore, the inevitable conclusion, therefore, Socrates was mortal. I'm sure you can follow that. If it is the case that all men are mortal, and if it is the case that Socrates was a man, then it follows inexorably, irrefutably, that Socrates was mortal. As Aristotle pointed out, it would be a very strange world, wouldn't it, if you could logically, without confusion, without contradiction, I should say, say, all men are mortal. Socrates was a man. Therefore, Socrates was immortal. Immediately, it's like being told that 2 times 2 make 5. You say, no, no. The rules of logic, the ingrained, the received, the a priori rules, rules that we haven't concocted. They are rules that confront us. The logical process confronts us as a element of thought, to which our minds must be subjected. We cannot change the laws of logic. This is what he said. Logic is absolute. And other examples that one could give are that nothing can both be and not be at the same time. One could go through all this. He expounded logic at great length. And so you could say that Aristotle was the founder of the process of thought that we today describe as the deductive process, of one point following logically from another. Robinson Crusoe on his desert island thought he was alone until one morning he went out just after the tide had gone down, and there on the beach he saw some naked footprints. And the obvious deduction from that was that he was not alone on the island, that there was somebody else there. Well, that is deduction. And if you read the novels of Arthur Conan Doyle, the Sherlock Holmes stories, you'll know how deduction plays a big part. Conan Doyle had no doubt read his Aristotle and followed that process through. And many of the examples you get in that, in the Sherlock Holmes stories, are beautiful examples of how this, if that has happened, then that says that something else must have happened before that, which means that this must have happened. And you're following these steps logically back, and that is deduction. And that is how a great deal of scientific exploration actually works. So he was the founder of logic, the creator, if you like. Not yet, logic preceded him, but the one who first drew our attention to it as a form of thought. What else did he do in metaphysics? Well, he argued, and he's following the same logical process, he argued that everything is he gave another syllogism. Everything that happens or exists has a cause. Now, I'm just pausing a minute while you think about that one. Everything has a cause. That is true, isn't it? That I'm looking at a curtain at the moment. This curtain didn't just come into being uncaused. Somebody wove it and sewed it and shaped it and coloured it and made it the sort of curtain it actually is. It was caused. And that is true of everything we see around us and of every creature you see around us. Everything was caused by something else. So, we begin with that statement. Everything that exists has a cause. Secondly, the universe exists. That's true. We can see it. We know it exists. So it's an example of what exists. Therefore, again following the same rules of logic that he'd outlined in the syllogism about Socrates, therefore the universe was caused. And he says, if that's the case, then there must be a God who was the first cause. And he sees, therefore, the existence of God as being logically necessary. He developed that argument in many shapes and forms, but to him this was irrefutable. Now, we've come in science today to the concept of a causality, and therefore perhaps that particular question or way of approaching this question is no longer quite as central as it was, though many people, when asked whether they believe in God, will still say something like, well, somebody must have made the universe happen. How else did the universe get here? Even if you believe in the Big Bang, somebody or something must have caused the Big Bang, else why did it happen? Did it happen spontaneously? How do things happen spontaneously? Somebody must have caused it to happen. And so that argument still is to be found. Of course, the real problem then is, as one has said, I think, in another, I've said in another lecture, you've then got to ask, well, if it is the case that everything that exists has a cause, then by that very premise, you've got to say, when you talk about God as the cause of the universe, who or what caused God? But that's another matter. The fact is that in the 13th century, the great Roman Catholic, or Catholic as it was then, theologian and philosopher, Thomas Aquinas wrote his massive summary of the whole of Christian theology, the Summa Theologica. And here's an interesting point. Here we have a man who was a monk, a devout Catholic, a Catholic scholar, a Catholic theologian. And yet throughout his Summa Theologica, he refers constantly to, quite simply, the philosopher. The philosopher. And he was referring to Aristotle. Now, don't you think this is remarkable, that a monk in the Middle Ages, trying to outline Christian doctrine, should fall back over and over again, continually throughout the book, on a philosopher who lived 3.5 centuries or more before Jesus arrived on the scene, before Christianity was born. It is quite a remarkable thing, and it shows, I think, what an incredible influence Aristotle had on the world for hundreds of years. This is the point, not just for a short time, but for hundreds of years. He was the supreme figurehead for human exploration, understanding, pursuit of knowledge. His thousand or more manuscripts after he died were lost for a while, and then eventually they were found, and his students did some cataloguing of them. But then they were lost again. They were lost again for about, until about the year 500. It's quite a remarkable story, really, about these manuscripts. And then around 500 AD, they were found, and you could say that they took over the academic intellectual activity of the Western world. In fact, it was only really after the time of the Renaissance that in the 15th or perhaps 16th centuries that Aristotle began to be questioned, because this business about stating what you observe, what he observed was, and of course he hadn't got any telescopes because telescopes had not been invented in those days, what he observed was that the stars, the sun and the moon were going round the earth. And he therefore concluded that the earth was the center of the universe. And that concept persisted right down to the time of Copernicus and Galileo. And even after that, they found it difficult to get their new ideas that the earth is just part of a solar system that goes round the sun. They found it difficult to get that accepted because Aristotle's view had taken such a hold on the thinking of people everywhere. This was opposed not only to the scriptures, that was bad enough, but it was also opposed to the teaching of Aristotle, the great philosopher, the philosopher, the man who single-handedly had written, and I go back to what I said a while ago, had single-handedly written the first ever Encyclopaedia Britannica. He was a walking encyclopedia. He knew everything that there was to be known. And that is awesome, really. Dante, the great Italian poet and man of religion, of course, described him as the master of those who know. The master of those who know. In other words, the greatest scholar who has ever lived. And I think, quite honestly, that that is the case, because he turned his attention to areas well beyond what we've looked at now. He looked at the question of what is art? What is a work of art? And any one of these subjects would have been enough for most human beings, but he turned his attention to the whole lot of them. What is art? And his description of art was that it acts as a catharsis, of a cleansing or purging of the human spirit. And that is something that modern artists, painters, musicians, poets, dramatists, sculptors, would still say. It is a purging of the spirit. It purifies you, art. It has that power, that strength. In ethics, he said that he was the first one to talk about that your moral decisions should be aimed at increasing happiness. This was a point of view that was to be taken up over 2,000 years later by the utilitarians. John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham argued that when making moral decisions, the aim that you should be pursuing is that of increasing as far as possible, or tending to increase, the sum total of human happiness. And Aristotle, in his book Nicomachean Ethics, said that, and John Stuart Mill acknowledged his indebtedness to Aristotle in his thinking about ethics. But perhaps most important, and this applies to one's life in general and to politics in particular, and it was Aristotle who said, man is a political animal. There's another one of his famous statements, man is a political animal. Meaning, I think, not so much that he's involved in sort of left and right-wing ideas in governing, but that polis, the Greek word polis, means a city, and therefore he says that basically the human being is a city dweller. He's not a rural dweller, and that he's disagreeing with a lot of the Eastern philosophers who we should look at elsewhere. But man is a political animal. What he meant was that we are necessarily got to live together. And in the process of living together, ideals, values, principles may well clash and cause friction between people. And that's what we've got to consider. We've got to see how people can manage to live together. It's all very well saying, as a lot of Eastern philosophers would say, go out and live as hermits and live out in the country and remove yourself from the flow of humanity. Aristotle says, no, we've got to live in that flow. We've got to live in the city. It's by living together that we'll create the best. And it's true, of course, isn't it, that if we'd always lived in villages, some of the great creations in sculpture and art and other elsewhere would not have been made. You may disagree with that, but I think that is the case, that it's in the city that the great creative achievements are made, because it's there that one mind, as it were, batters itself against another, and one idea of creativity meets another, and between them they build something greater than them both, and so on. Well, in his idea of how to live and how to live politically, Aristotle brought out his concept, which again is famous for. In fact, it's probably his most famous idea, which is that we should live according to what he called the golden mean. Nothing in excess. To live a life where you're not too overworked, you're not a workaholic, though, my goodness me, reading of him, one feels he must have been a workaholic. How on earth did he get all that writing done? But anyway, he says not to be a workaholic and not to be a playboy. In a way, he's saying we must balance it out in the sense that the Chinese philosophy of yin and yang says that you're involved in both. But on the whole, he's saying more that we should keep to that middle of the road all the time, that we should follow the mean, nothing in excess, everything under control. And it's what St. Paul also described in his one of his letters when he talked about enkratia, self-control, enjoying something but not going overboard about it. If you're working hard, fine, but then know when to stop. If you're relaxing, recognize that you will enjoy your relaxation more if you're balancing it with the work, and keeping along the middle path, the golden mean. And I suspect, though we don't know, that Aristotle himself must have lived a life very much akin to that. We have pictures of him, but whether he actually looked like that, I don't know. But he certainly looks very handsome in one or two of the very famous pictures of him. Well, there we are. Plato, Aristotle, and Plato's teacher Socrates. Three men who between them have shaped the thinking of the entire Western world and also of the Eastern world. It always fills my mind with wonder as to what could have happened if they could have met some of their opposite numbers. For example, Mencius, the Chinese Confucian, was a contemporary of them both. And if they could have met Mencius, what might then have accrued? But of course, they didn't, because they couldn't. But in these three men, we have the makings of human intellectual achievement. More than to anybody else, certainly in the Western world, our academic enterprise goes back to them and leans on them. We may today be able to see further than Socrates or Plato or Aristotle, but it is only because we are standing on their shoulders.